Welcome to the Couchcast slot, and this week, and for the next couple of weeks, we're going to relive a few of the most popular shows while I'm off chairing an international transit mapping symposium, like you do. So this week, we're replaying the most popular Couchcast on the Vectis Radio podcast page, the one in which I spoke to two designers about the infamous New York subway map back in April this year. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. This is our new weekly show, chatting art, transport, communications, history, the CATCH. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by these geeky subjects as myself and the guests. So welcome aboard the Couchcast. In today's edition, we're talking about the biggest news in design and transport, and that is the New York City subway map has been changed from a geographic map to a diagram. Why does this matter? What makes it unusual, and how did it all come about? Well, today we're honoured to be joined live from Portland, Oregon, by the webmaster of the world's biggest portal on transportation maps, Cameron Booth of transitmap.net.
Hey, nice to see you, Mac.
Hey, thanks for being there. And from Scotland, by author and expert on the New York City transit map, Peter Lloyd.
Oh, hi.
And welcome both. Well, before we start those questions, I wonder if we can sort of set the scene a bit of how the New York subway became so large and how its cartography evolved prior to the Second World War.
I think the subway seems to newcomers to be totally forbidding, overwhelming, overcomplex, and possibly insane. In fact, there was a cartographer who the Transit Authority asked to survey the new maps in the mid-60s, and his view was it's impossible to make a good map of the subway because it's drenched in insanity. But it's not. It actually serves a very good purpose. Back in the day of 1904, the idea was to enable workers not to have to live in tenements in smoky downtown Manhattan, but live out in the countryside in the suburbs, but they require express trains to bring them in. And so the subway was built to allow people to come to work and go home again fairly quickly and cheaply. And it did that very well. And what we've inherited is a complex system with both these express lines enabling people to get in and out quickly and local lines to find a way around inside the boroughs. But although that's great for passengers, it's a headache for map makers.
So Cameron, you've been collecting maps for a long time. Have you got any examples of what some of those early maps looked like? What does it actually look like in print to see those different lines on one map?
Well, I mean, obviously early on, there were the three separate companies running the New York subway. What we perceive as the New York subway now is three separate different companies, and they issued their own maps, which tended to ignore the other two companies completely, which of course made life interesting if you actually like needed to transfer between the different divisions to catch your trains. So early maps are pretty crudely drawn a lot of the time. A lot of them actually turn Manhattan on its side, which is interesting when you consider the view we have of it now. But it took a long time, I think, for any sort of cohesive map to actually get developed where it sort of looked at the system as a holistic whole. I think Peter might have some insight into that.
Yeah, the biggest change, of course, was the move from geographic maps to diagrammatic ones. But during the first half of the 20th century, from 1920s to 1950s, the subway map was dominated by one man, Andrew Hagstrom, who was really quite an aggressive businessman. Before coming to New York to make maps, he made sausages. And it's only by chance he didn't end up as being Germany's greatest sausage maker. He loved being wallowing in blood and guts. And when he came to New York, he loved the jungle atmosphere of pushing other businesses around. And so he really dominated the New York map scene, in fact, the map scene generally. And his map integrated, he saw the business opportunity of having an integrated map, bringing all three of those companies that Cameron mentioned, the IRT, BMT, and IND, onto one map to serve the people better. That map really carried on till mid-50s when a German emigre called George Salomon arrived in New York and thought, this is hell, I can't find my way around. Now, he spent some time in London and he saw what a good diagram could do. And so he proposed to the TA, or Board of Transportation as it was then, let's do a London-style diagram map. And that's what happened. And that was the beginning of 20 years of diagrams.
So what did that first Salaman diagram look like then? Was it identical to the way that London did their maps?
Cameron, I'm sure you've got these in your collection.
Yeah, I absolutely do. No, it's very, you know, for want of a better word, it's very 1950s styled. You know, it's very much of its era. It's sort of thin lines and boxes at all the stations and stuff like that. But I think it's interesting because, you know, later on when the Vinelli diagram got introduced, you know, the main complaint was, oh, New Yorkers don't like diagrams. It already had one for 15 years before that, you know. Yeah. So I always find that argument a little hard to understand, that, you know, New Yorkers don't like diagrams because we never had one. It's like, you did. You absolutely had one. It was just a different style. Very rounded corners, very, you know, it really does look like something from the 1950s. Whereas I think Vinelli came in and it came with his diagram and it was very modernist. It was very clean. And I think that's the difference between the two.
Well, I think in some ways, Vinelli went back to the elegance of George Salaman's map. At the end of the 60s, there was a need to introduce color coding. So George Salaman's map had the three colors for three companies. And then because of Christie Street, this little two-mile tunnel under Chinatown, it merged together two of those three networks. So they had to come up with a new scheme. And that was our friend Raleigh D'Adamo had the idea, well, let's do a separate color for its route. But the way that was done at the end of the 60s, in 67, was a total mess. And what Vinelli did was to clear up that mess, that excess of information, that noise, that clutter, go back to the elegance of George Salaman's map. And that's what we then had, is a multicolored map with that minimalist elegance.
Have either of you got copies of those, say, for example, those late 60s maps? What did they look like? How were they different from the Salaman one then?
Well, the one thing is that they did two different things at the same time. Vinelli is famous for his minimalist no dot, no stop rule. So you see the parallel lines of the subway system, and when there's a dot, it means the train stops there. And if you have two parallel lines with a dot in both lines, then you can change from one line to the other. And so the 67 map had that feature, nice and elegant, but also at the same time, it had a box for each station with a list, a laundry list of all the services stopping there. So everything was there in double information, of what Vinelli called fake information. And so the topology of it is similar to what we see both in Salaman and Vinelli, but overlaid with massive amounts of clutter.
Right. So the signage on the subway was changing with the Unimark company. Vinelli was coming in with his ideas. We need to know what happened next. Can we talk a bit more about how this new design from Massimo Vinelli was received?
There's a lot of myth, I believe, about this. People say that New York hated the map and rejected it, couldn't bear having diagrams. But as Cameron just said, New York had diagrams since 1958. They already knew how to navigate with a diagram. What happened in mid-70s is that, contrary to what some people believe, the Vinelli map was loved. The MTA made about $54,000 a year from Vinelli merchandise. T-shirts, boxer shorts, stilt dresses, tote bags. People couldn't get enough of the Vinelli map. Although there are always some people who hate every single map that's ever existed, the fact is that people in general really like the map, and it was no more difficult to navigate than the preceding diagram. What happened at the end of the 70s is that it was binned for no apparent reason. People just guessed. They supposed, oh, well, some people must have disliked them. It's been thousands of complaint letters. And so the myth built up, snowballed, and you have this view that New York rejected the Vinelli map. It didn't. Basically, one man rejected it in the MTA.
Okay. Well, we're gonna talk about that rejection process. Cameron, have you got some copies of the original Vinelli map from the 70s?
I have a print of a high-res scan of it on my wall right in front of me now. It sort of sits above my computer as a reminder of, you know, the kind of designs I want to achieve when I'm making my own maps.
So New York City got its stunning diagram in the 1970s. I would have thought it had been really popular. How was it received?
Well, certain people, namely the public, loved it. They received it very well and went out and bought all the merchandise they could find. T-shirts, silk dresses, tote bags. The MTA made $54,000 a year from selling Vinelli merchandise. But certain individuals did not like the idea of reducing the glorious city of New York to beige blobs on a sheet of paper.
Wasn't there a big debate about the diagram in one of the universities or something?
Yeah, that's right, the Cooper Union. So what happened is that this guy, John Toronak, had a vision of the map going back to geography, because he said that the map should tell you where everything is in the city, not just where the subway lines are. And his new map, or the map from his committee, was presented to the AIGA, the American Institute of Graphics. And they went ballistic. They thought, this is crazy. The Vignelli map is the best map in the universe, and the MTA are throwing it out and getting some messy, crazy, snapshot geographic map. And they said, we need to have a big public debate to sort this out.
And what happened at that debate? I mean, I think you've got some notes about it somewhere, haven't you, Peter? You discovered some history of it.
Well, fortuitously, the recording of the debate suddenly appeared a few years ago, and Gary Huswit was the lucky guy who stumbled across this first and published a book giving us that transcript. And we can see really quite an interesting, but it's really a show trial. The conclusion was already decided by the MTA. They knew where they were going. And in fact, if you remember, Mark, we interviewed John Toronak and asked him, could the outcome have been different if there'd been a different reaction from that debate? He said, no, it wouldn't have made any difference at all. The MTA was already set on this path of getting a map that would serve to sell the city by showing all the topology, the parks and stadia. And the debate was interesting to reveal the two positions, the pro-diagram and pro-geography. But it was, as I said, a show trial. It's just a way of demonstrating to the public, yes, the MTA is listening, but it didn't.
So when did this new geographic-based map by, I think it was Michael Hertz and John Toronak, when did that come out? And what did it actually look like? What would it have been like to have held it?
I bet Cameron hasn't got one on his wall.
I do not have one of those on my wall. I think 1979 it came out, right? And to be honest, it looks much the same as the geographic subway map does now. I mean, there's some differences between it. Obviously, a similar map for 40-odd years, and it's not identical from beginning to end. But you would look at it and say, oh, that's the predecessor of the current map. I mean, it's quite visually, strikingly very similar.
And was it easy to use? Could you just look at it quickly when you're on the subway? Was it like a pocket map?
I think it only works in poster size. I don't think you could shrink it down much more than that and still have a legible map. I mean, it's like you're looking at an actual road map in a lot of ways. It takes a lot of detailed perusal to find the information you're after. It's not for quick scanning. And I think this is the advantage that diagrams have over maps, right, is taking this information and making it clear quickly. I mean, in the industry, they talk about the 8-second rule. Like, if the people don't understand where they're going within 8 seconds of looking at the diagram, it's a failure.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that the Toronto map is like a Swiss Army knife. It's got everything on it, but it's a bit fiddly to get the information out.
And it didn't pass the 8-second rule.
Just not past that 8-second rule.
But it was redesigned, wasn't it? I think in 1998, a little bit.
I think they digitized it at that point. So basically,
the big change there was to put the commuter trains on the back of the map. It was digitized, I think, about 1994. And then Michael Hertz basically took over the operation and put the. So then, rather than having a separate sheet of paper for each of the different commuter trains, the Metro North and Long Island Bay Road, you had one piece of paper with the subway on one side and the complete computer network on the other side, which is really quite handy, even though, as you say, it still doesn't pass the 8-second rule.
So after almost 40 years of geographic map, what has just happened?
Well, they just announced, I had to check the date on it because they announced it on April the 2nd, that they had changed from the geographical style map that they've been using for the last 40 years and going back to a diagrammatic map heavily based on that Massimo Vignelli map from the 1970s. It's kind of earth-shaking. I mean, for New York to basically sort of say we're taking what we've done for the last 40 years and we're not doing that anymore, and instead we're doing, well, basically what every other transit system around the world is doing, but, you know, New York has a very high opinion of itself. And yeah, it's really interesting to see. And, you know, I'm looking at the map on my screen now, and it's, you know, for a complex system like New York, I think they've done a pretty decent job.
Peter, what do you think of the new diagram?
Well, I think you have to remember that MTA is a bit like Pavlov's dog. It was bitten in the 70s. There was a perception, which I think is mistaken, a perception that the Vignelli map had been rejected by New York travelers. And so although there's been certain elements within the MTA who want to go back to a diagram, as Cameron said, every other big city in the world uses a diagram. And so there has been certain internal pressures to go back to a diagram in the MTA. But they didn't want to have a bad report from it. MTA loves the public, loves the riders, and doesn't want them to hate them back. And so there's been a resistance, a hesitation towards going back to the diagram, which with Steve Flam's work on the flamograms, I call it, this new diagram, he's managed to convince the stakeholders that this is the way to go. And so now we have this resurgence of diagrammaticity, which was actually loved in the 70s. And it's the geographic map has everything. It's got all the information in there, but you have to dig to get it. And now you've got a map which maybe it passes the 8-second rule, but maybe there's now so much more information on it, it's kind of maybe following the 9-second rule.
They have added layers of information to it when you compare it to that 1970s diagram, I think. On the other hand, one of the big improvements is using the colors for the separate trunks through Manhattan, just unified now, as opposed to sort of the rainbow-like colors of the 1970s version. You know, I think definitely working out, you know, so there's red on the 1, 2, 3 and green on the 4, 5, 6. It helps unify the map a little bit better. It helps understand how these lines double up and provide more frequency through Manhattan and stuff like that as well. So I think there's a lot of good elements to it. And I think it's important to note that this has been a long process to get here. I mean, you can date this back to like 2006. They did a version in Vogue magazine that Massimo Vignelli worked on. And then there was a version in 2012 that the New York Subway put on their website as the Weekender service map. And then there's been a pilot program for this map for at least 2 or 3 years. This has been a very slow and gradual process to get to this point. And I think the result shows that there's been a lot of thought put into this. This isn't something they just slapped together over a weekend.
Yeah, I think that the amount of thought is enormous, that there's so many people looking over Steve Flam's shoulders, giving their opinions internally and externally. They actually invited a lot of people, public, to comment on the map. There was for a while a QR code to submit your comments, which apparently was hacked and they got lots of rubbish there. But they really invited people to express their views, to give constructive criticism internally and externally. And I think there's been the reason for the long process is they've had to think about each of these issues and see if there's some way to change the map to deal with the possible problems people have. And you can't please everyone. You know, there's no map that's perfect for everyone. And they've had to reach a compromise. And I think they've now arrived at the point where everyone has agreed within the MTA, yes, this is the best that we can do at the present time.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit towards the end about hybrids and other different types of map and different offerings. But was there also not a live map at some point as well?
There was. And I think that's still live, actually. And I was pretty critical of that when it came out. A lot of people just like, wow, look at what you can do with the technology. And I was just like, a lot of it takes some really weird liberties with the layout of the lines. And it didn't actually work that well on most web browsers. It was really slow. So I think it was like a diagram overlaid on a geographical map. And sometimes the lines followed the geography. And sometimes they like stair-stepped weirdly to where they were going. And sometimes they just followed the curve of the land. So it couldn't make up its mind whether it was a diagram, a map, or a map and a diagram. You know, it was very strange, but it was received quite well at the time, but I wasn't buying it.
I think a lot of people regard that as a joke map. It wasn't part of the evolution of the official New York Subway map. That was following a clear line.
A little gimmicky,
I mean, it demonstrated the capabilities of software, but in terms of actually delivering a day-to-day map, I don't think anyone regarded it as a candidate substitute for the Toronto map.
So the New York history was we had geographic maps, then diagrams, then we went back to geographic, and now we've got a diagram. I'm wondering, is there room, like some other cities do, to have a bit of both? So, for example, you issue a diagram, but there are also geographic maps available. Is there room for both?
No, I think paper maps are too 20th century. I think the movement now is very much towards electronic maps. We have electronic displays throughout the subway now. We can imagine a situation where you can flip between geographic and diagrammatic. I think that's the way that we're going, that we have the flexibility that digital maps give us to do daytime maps, nighttime maps, diagram maps, geographic maps, maps you can zoom into, a bit like the Eddie Jabbar's kick map. Flexible digital maps, I think that's where we're going.
I think there's definitely potential here, you know, once they get their digital signage working and all hooked up, of it being able to reflect service changes within the subway in real time, which I think is going to be a game changer for New York, because if you've ever been there when they're running service changes, it could do your head in.
So I know, for example, Vienna is working really hard to develop completely live, real-time live schematic maps inside each vehicle. I wonder whether we'll get to that in New York.
I think they've got to be heading towards something like that. I just feel like a system of that size, being able to get push information instantly out to riders, is just got to be one of the DMTA's biggest goals.
And do we then think, as Peter said, that we are reaching the end of the printed paper map?
I mean, New York has a printed paper map, but I don't know if it's ever had the same popularity as, say, the London Tube's journey planner, you know, which like everyone just grabs when they go and catch the tube, right? You could get it, but it was always it was a bigger format as well. It's not like pocket sized. Yeah. It's much larger because you have to unfold it to this giant map. So, yeah, I don't know if the New Yorkers have the same fondness for the paper map that London does. Like, I can imagine the journey planner is going to carry on in London for quite some time past its nominal use-by date.
Well, it's not that easy to get journey planners now in London. Many of the ticket offices have closed down. They have people wandering around instead. And there's no central place to pick up a map. I think in all cities, there's a movement away from pocket paper maps. Bigger, they're expensive, and everyone now has a smartphone.
Yeah, everyone has a smartphone. I will note, though, that on the MTA website at the moment, they offer both the diagram and the geographic map. They're hedging their bets a little bit.
Well, not so much hedging their bets. I think providing people with a range of products to serve their different purposes.
That's probably true.
Because a big city like New York or Chicago, Paris, Berlin, whatever, I think that you probably do need to offer people more than one solution. But it sounds like you both at least believe that it's good news it's returned to a diagrammatic form.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note as well that this map will probably be backed up by locality maps and geographical maps of the area at each station. I mean, this is the one Vignelli always planned, right, is that you'd get to the station, there'd be the subway map, and there'd be the commuter rail map, and there would be a map of the area around the station, so you could finish your journey using that map. A lot of the complaints I hear about this is that they're like, oh, you need to see everything on the map because you want to know where you're going when you get off the train, and there's the argument, which I think Harry Beck had, the subway map is for the journey on the train, and then there's another map to finish your journey once you get off the train.
Well, there was interestingly a acerbic comment by Michael Hertz, who was the graphic designer hired to do the Toronto committee map. He said, New York is an above-ground city. You don't go to a station, you go to a place. The only people who go from station to station are the toilet cleaners. And really, you want a map showing you how to get where you're going. There is no perfect map. On the one hand, you do want to know where you go in a particular destination, but also you want an eight-second accessible map to show you which station to get to. And that, I think, is what has made the history of the New York subway map so fascinating, to see how people have tried to square the circle. You can't get a map that does both.
On that controversial note, next time you take a trip to New York City, you'll find a diagrammatic map that may be easier to use than the previous geographic offering. Thanks very much to author Peter Lloyd. His books are available online, and to Cameron Booth of the stunning website transitmap.net. Next week, we'll be having another Catchcast replayed with Simon Turner, who returns to talk about railway honor auctions.